The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today we'll be venturing into primate territory with Vanessa Woods, author of Bonobo Handshake, a memoir of love and adventure in the Congo. She'll take us inside Lola Ya Bonobo Sanctuary, a refuge for orphaned baby bonobos, and we'll discuss what their behavior may tell us about ours. And today we're also introducing a new segment on Skeptically Speaking, Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong, with Greg Layden. Greg is a biological anthropologist, veteran guest on Skeptically Speaking, and author of the descriptively titled Greg Layden's blog. Welcome back to the show, Greg.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
So before we get to our first episode of Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong, can you tell us what people can expect from this series?
Yeah, this is basically a radio version of an overhead slide that I made several years ago when I realized that in teaching undergraduate classes in biology and related topics, that there were a lot of things that students came to the table already understanding and knowing stuff about, but they basically had it wrong in ways that were difficult or disturbing or even a little harmful sometimes, and that needed to be kind of undone. You couldn't just give them new knowledge or get them to discover new knowledge. They had to criticize, self-criticize, and remove old ways of thinking. So this led to a list of falsehoods. It was interesting that I had this list of falsehoods I used for several years. And when I met my wife, turns out a high school teacher, she had also a list of falsehoods. And they overlap significantly. These are things that people tend to walk around thinking, or not even consciously thinking, but they just know them. So if you say a certain thing out loud, people nod and agree. But it turns out that what you said out loud is egregiously wrong or flawed or in a nuanced way, maybe incorrect. And the process of examining it itself is a learning process. It's a way of undoing sort of bad thinking or bad knowledge and replacing it with more critically thought out and more accurate, better knowledge. You could say truth if you wanted to. And so that's basically the list. And so then when I first started blogging, the very first blogging I did pretty much was, I'd done this several times, going through the cycle of, you know, listing the falsehoods and discussing them and seeing how people react to them. And I've been learning over time how to explain them to people in a way that actually is effective, because I get feedback on the blog in which I can see, well, I said that in a way that made people more mad than I needed to, or they just didn't go right, and so on.
Right. I do read your blog, so I know exactly what you mean. So today we'll be talking about primitive cultures. So Let's define some terms. What is primitive?
Well, that's actually, defining the terms is actually a key part of it, because the falsehood is that primitive cultures are simple and modern or civilized cultures are complex, and that reflects on the people in those cultures. And if you actually read my current installation, there are a lot of people telling me I'm defining complex wrong, or I'm defining Western wrong. But that's the point. These are words that themselves, people who really study cultures and societies don't use these words so much, because they're loaded terms that have meanings that have baggage. So that the meaning has many meanings and you really only meant one. So, but really what we're talking about is primitive cultures is the word that we no longer use anymore for people who are living in what we also don't call a state of nature. In other words, they don't have electricity, they don't have roads and cars and machines, they're living off the land as hunter-gatherers. I'm making this particular distinction of hunter-gatherers. There's many other people who also grow food who would count in these sort of societies, as opposed to civilization, which is where you have a higher level of organization of the society, higher literally hierarchically, meaning you have your village and your family, but there's someone else in charge you may occasionally run into, and some kind of larger scale economy, some kind of larger scale political system, and so on, and manifests in the modern world as state societies like the United States, Canada, and so on. The other big difference that's kind of a single thing that permeates everything is energy. Quote-unquote primitive societies don't use fossil fuels and electricity. Civilized societies, so-called, rely entirely on an energy distribution system for everything that they do.
And you would say that most people assume that primitive cultures are simple, but civilization is complex.
Yeah, and in a sense, you know, the wonders of modern society, technology, literacy, industry, all of it imbues the members of those societies with admirable traits such as intelligence, complexity, personal abilities, and so on. If we're living in a society in which genius is required to make the things we use, then it makes us all geniuses by association. That's the falsehood part. All you have to do is be in the society, as opposed to people living in primitive societies where the world is simple, life is simple, you're living in a state of nature. Those people do not have to be that smart. They don't have to be that intelligent. They just, have their own way of life, and there's no genius behind it. One thing that I do not discuss in my blog post, but people have been asking me about is, what harm does this belief have? And it does, in the sense that it's almost always this is a racial issue. There's issues of Western privilege and exceptionalism and so on that are simply supported by this kind of idea, plus the lack of self-referential thinking among civilized, quote-unquote civilized people. Is it really true that we're all that smart? Is it really true that our societies are well-organized and brilliant manifestations of human behavior, or is this a little bit of a random emergent phenomenon that we may not have as much control over as we think we do?
And so you would say?
I would say that we don't. I mean, I think that it's interesting that I think it was Jared Diamond that pointed out no civilization that we know of has ever had a department of how to stop civilization from collapsing. Closest thing we have today is the EPA, because environmental degradation is a cause of civilization collapse in many previous cases. But normally, civilizations aren't self-referential in that way at all. The other thing that's, to me, really important personally, because I worked for so long in the Ituri Forest in Zaire, during the first Gulf War, we in America were very strongly affected by being involved in a war as a nation. But most people were not affected at all, because hardly anyone really knew anyone in the military, and everyone went on with their life without any significant changes other than the news being different. The pygmies who lived in the middle of nowhere in the Ituri Forest, things happened to them that were interesting. They had people coming into the forest they'd never seen before demanding that they go hunting for meat. The reason for that is because the cities had run out of fish. And the cities had run out of fish because the gasoline and diesel used to do the fishing on the Great Lakes several hundred miles away had dried up just because spot oil prices had gone up.
Wouldn't that be an example of why exactly modern society is so complex? Because we do need those things?
Exactly. And in a sense, the central argument of this falsehood discussion is really that you don't have to be personally very smart to live in a complex society, because society is so complex, it takes care of all that for you. All you really need to do is to run a microwave, and you really need very little to get by on a day-to-day basis. Not that everyone only gets by on a day-to-day basis, but you don't need much. Whereas a hunter-gatherer, in hunter-gatherer societies, everyone needs to be very good at and very expert at and very experienced at a lot of things and have a lot of important social cooperation and so on. I mean, it's just true that whenever a bunch of Westerners get lost in the woods, their plane goes down and there are survivors, or there are explorers who get lost somewhere, they always die and often resort to cannibalism along the way. And those are not environments that humans can't live in. Those are environments that there are hunter-gatherers or were hunter-gatherers at one time living in. But Western people can't do it. At the same time, hunter-gatherers brought into a Western setting, that's a very rare event to see happen. But it has happened, and they do extraordinarily well.
But isn't that also an example of why society is more complex? Because we don't know how to do everything. We need to specialize in order to get everything done.
Right. No one person in Western society could do all the things that Western society does. And it's interesting to note that people in Western society have several ways of amusing ourselves. And two of the most common ways of amusing ourselves are pretend you're a hunter-gatherer. You go camping, you go hunting, you gather mushrooms, you're a bird watcher.
Interesting.
All those are entertainments we use. Or the other thing is to try to break into that civilization doing everything for you, the do-it-yourself stuff. People who love to cook. You don't need to do that. You can buy everything prepared. People who cook to save money are rare. People who cook because it's fun are usually spending more money than if you were buying the food prepared. It's a hobby. Getting a little bit more like a hunter-gatherer because you're getting directly involved in those things. Or people who build their own radios or whatever. Look at Make Magazine and look at all the do-it-yourself projects in there. Two ways we amuse ourselves are cracking into that civilization veneer and getting into the guts, like from that movie Brazil, those pipes and tubes that are behind the walls in our own civilization on one hand, or pretending that we're hunter-gatherers on the other. And breaking out of that civilization mode, it is in fact, and this is something evolutionary psychologists, bless their pointy heads, have been saying since they started thinking about this, and Darwinian psychologists, that our diseases today we get in Western civilization are called diseases of civilization. We die of things that hunter-gatherers can't die from, because they don't have those problems that we have created for ourselves by being in a society in which the complexity is significantly increased but compartmentalized and specialized And chances are that thing you put in the microwave to cook is not something that you should be eating.
Well, isn't this verging on the naturalistic fallacy?
Yes, and we have to be very careful when we get to that. That's a good point. The naturalistic fallacy, just like all the falsehoods, there's truth here. Hunter-gatherer society is simple and modern society is complex. That's true, but the imbuing individuals with those characteristics because their societies are different is the false part. The naturalistic fallacy has some very real parts to it. All else being equal, Mel Konner and Boyd Eaton and Marjorie Shostak years ago, who worked for the Bushmen in Namibia and Botswana, predicted the ideal human diet based upon what they ate. That's a naturalistic assumption. They're eating what is good for them and they're not eating what's bad for them. Or at least, let's put it this way, the diet that humans have evolved to consume for the last couple million years is a diet that's going to do less harm to you, probably, than the diet that you run into in a completely alien context. And the kind of fats and cholesterol, the kinds of nutrients, the amount of meat and fat and carbohydrate and so on in a diet, complex versus simple carbohydrates, all those proportions that the nutritionists tell us now are ideal were predicted in 1972 by those anthropologists. And only now the last piece is being put in place in those recommendations, which is now it is recommended that you feed your six-month-old baby meat instead of rice or along with the mush rice. And that is something that the Bushman Project people have been saying all along because there's actually good nutritional reasons to do it. That's what foragers tend to do. So the naturalistic fallacy is the uncritical assumption that that which is natural is good, that which is unnatural is bad. But the truth is that that which occurs in a quote-unquote state of nature is a good hint for how things might work better.
Let's talk about intelligence then, because we always hear that people have had to become increasingly more intelligent to deal with the increasing complexity of our society. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I think people do say that. That's correct that people say that. And there's a lot of things here that are involved. And one of them is the supposed correlation between brain size and intelligence, which is roughly on a large scale, probably real, but on a minor within species scale is clearly not accurate. And it's interesting to note that human populations have probably had reductions in average brain size with the origin of agriculture. And we also find it's very hard to get the data, but the few pieces of data we have show that hunter-gatherer brain sizes tend to be relative to body size big. However, most of those data are from either Arctic regions or subarctic regions where everyone's brains tend to be big anyway, or they're from people who are small.
Right.
So it's hard to know. And then there's the idea of distributed intelligence. Once you distribute your intelligence, this is Howard Bloom's idea, you know, we distribute our intelligence among many individuals. As a group, we're pretty smart, but most individuals have to be that smart. And some do, but most don't. So there should be reduced selection on individual abilities to adapt and learn and remember and know stuff. You know, I mean, it's interesting, you know, the last time, you know, if you talk about hunter-gatherer intelligence, okay, they know the names and uses and so on of thousands of species of plants. And a lot of Westerners respond to that with, oh, isn't that cute? And that's a skill. It's like fixing your, I know a guy can fix his carburetor and he's pretty smart in that way, but not really smart, like you would know algebra and calculus smart, okay? But the last time I saw a person pointing out plants and knowing their uses and not being able to be stumped on any question about any plant in their environment, it was a guy with a PhD in that topic, and everyone was very impressed with it. You know, so how we categorize knowledge and intelligence as to whether we count it as being real intelligence versus just being a skill that people in a natural environment learn is usually one of those very self-serving, non-objective, highly subjective kinds of things. And usually along the lines is kind of a reverse naturalistic fallacy. That which is associated with nature sort of comes naturally. You don't have to work for it. That which is not is what you must strive to obtain. And striving, this is a classic Victorian notion, you know, striving for these things is the nature of civilized society. We strive to overcome nature, et cetera, et cetera.
So do you think it just makes us feel better then to assume that society is more complex now?
It probably makes us feel better, but also the fallacy, and I just want to point out one more thing about why we know this fallacy exists. Every time I've posted anything on this, I get a lot of people saying to me, you know, you're defining civilization wrong, or your definition of civilization is too simple, or it's wrong in some way. No one has ever criticized my definition of primitive. You know, the primitive part is people just assume, oh yeah, at the end of the conversation, people may be quite enlightened, but they still assume that there are primitive, simple people living in a state of nature somewhere in the rainforest. And they don't get the fact that there's a continuum between societies. And there are many ways in which you can expect you would just be very surprised if you lived among pygmies for a few months. You know, I mean, the average person would be very surprised at what they found and the sort of the stuff that they observed there. And every single Westerner that the pygmies that I worked with ever met is either a PhD student or someone with multiple PhDs, every single one, who was interested in studying them and who was there kind of on their side politically. So it's like all the Australians I've ever met for many years were just people in academia. I'll bet the average Australian is not a PhD student in anthropology, a liberal, you know, thinking, you know. So it's just we had these very biased views of each other's perspectives and cultures already.
Do you think that it just makes us feel better to assume that our society is more complex?
Right. It probably does. And that could be why people are upset about the civilization definition but ignore the primitive definition. It could be why it happens, but I also think it is an end product of our educational system. It's an end product of the fact that our history and social sciences teaching in schools has a story that begins with the murky hunter-gatherer Cro-Magnon living in caves past and works its way into focus. Humans as humans come into focus and the details emerge and the motivations and the successes and so on become detailed as we get closer and closer to the more recent times. And skipping over a few dark ages here and there, you have classical civilizations ultimately leading to Renaissance and so on. And that builds up. It's like basically everyone grows up in our society knowing a version, a resume of Western society and knowing nothing about other societies. And it's a pretty impressive resume when it's given in the way it's given.
Greg, I think our new series, Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong, is going to be a bit of a thought experiment every time.
That's the idea. That's what a falsehood is. It's a thought experiment.
Perfect. Greg, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
And the blog posts I mentioned and the fact that there are three on this topic, actually, are all on Greg's blog. So if you'd like to discuss it or to argue with Greg about it, because that actually happens quite a bit on his blog, do go to scienceblogs.com/Greg Layden and just search for primitive cultures. I definitely look forward to more of these, and we will be right back with more Skeptically Speaking right after this.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, either through the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still hear the broadcast live in our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by clicking on the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to those stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including Citywide LPFM 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, CJLY Kootenai Cooperative Radio 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia, CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia, CJAI Amherst Island Public Radio 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario, CLHI Rosslyn Radio 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia, Freethought Radio, WPRR Public Reality Radio 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, CIDO 97.7 FM in Creston, British Columbia, UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, CFAD 92.1 FM in Salmo, British Columbia, CLHS 100.5 FM in Lillooet, British Columbia, CKOA FM The Coast 89.7 FM in Cape Breton, Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, CKMS 100.3 in Waterloo, Ontario, and CILU 102.7 FM in Thunder Bay, Ontario.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today we'll be talking with Vanessa Woods. Vanessa is a research scientist at Duke University who studies the cognitive development of chimpanzees and bonobos. She's also an award-winning journalist and author, and her newest book is Bonobo Handshake, a memoir of love and adventure in the Congo. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Vanessa.
Hey, Desiree, how are you?
I'm very well. So this is quite the book. It's kind of a cross between a romance novel and a research diary, some softcore bonobo porn in there?
Yeah, soft porn for bonobos always goes down well, I find. You know, alone on a Saturday night, getting so much, you can just read the book and read about the love lives of others.
Well, give us some background on it.
What, with the soft porn or the book?
Or, well, you could start with the book. We'll get to the bonobo porn later.
Let's start with the book. So I, 2005, fell in love with this guy. You know, some men take their women on to dinner or, you know, to romantic weekends away. And mine took me to Congo to study these sort of apes that I'd never heard of, bonobos. And he was looking for the key to what makes us human. And so he thought that these were a great model for that because usually we only study chimpanzees. So, you know, bonobos, they're very rare. We know hardly anything about them, but yet, you know, they share equal amounts of our DNA with as chimpanzees. So, yeah, they're important. They're an important part of the question.
Well, what's also an important part of this is the political situation in the Congo. Let's start there.
Sure. They have suffered the bloodiest war since World War II. I think the estimates are up to like 5.4 million people have died there now. So, I mean, it's approaching Holocaust proportions. The people in Congo have suffered inordinately from a war that that sometimes gets called a civil war, and that annoys me because it was very much an international war, and the US and Australia and Europe played a large part in keeping that war going.
And that's one of the reasons that bonobos haven't really been studied up until quite recently.
Yes, it was a very violent country for almost a decade, so no researchers could really get in or out. And so bonobos only live in the Democratic Republic of Congo, so yeah, it was tough.
Up until very recently, bonobos had been considered sort of a lesser species of chimp then?
Yeah, sometimes they get called a pygmy chimpanzee, which is quite unfortunate because it sort of implies that they're the cute miniature version of the real thing. But bonobos are a fully fledged species in their own right with some very significant differences to chimpanzees.
What kind of differences?
Well, for one thing, bonobos live in a female-dominated society, and chimpanzees, you could argue, just like humans, they live in a male-dominated society, and they do some nasty things like beat their females and kill their infants, and they have war, and occasionally they torture and kill each other. You know, I'm not a chimpanzee racist. They also have some very beautiful qualities to them. They, you know, they love, they have emotions like empathy. If you believe the recent news reports, they mourn their dead. So, you know, it's like the chimpanzees are kind of like the Star Wars version where they have like the light side, but they also have the dark side. And then bonobos are just like pure Yoda. They are everything that's good.
Vanessa, you understand our target audience.
So, yeah, I am a really big Star Wars fan before Star Wars got lame. So, you know, the original one with Harrison Ford, that is the Star Wars I believe in. Yes, the bonobos are the Yoda of that version, not the new version.
Now, although you love bonobos, chimps were actually your first love.
I did. I fell in love with chimpanzees when I was in my early 20s. I worked at a sanctuary, an orphanage, much like the bonobo orphanage where we work now. And I had this little baby orphan called Bluku, and he arrived, and I took care of him for a month before he could be released onto the island.
So what happened here? How did you wind up in the Congo? Now, I understand you fell in love, but that's more of a process, really.
Oh, yeah. It is more of a process. But, I mean, so bonobos only live in Congo. So if you want to study them, that's where you got to go. There's only seven zoos in America that have them out of all the hundreds and hundreds of zoos. And, you know, there's none in biomedical facilities, so you can't test them there. So if you want to study bonobos, that's where you're going.
And you specifically go to Lola Ya Bonobo Sanctuary.
Yes, so Lola Ya Bonobo, you can look it up on the website, friendsofbonobos.org. It's a beautiful sanctuary. It was actually the last forest in Kinshasa, and the dictator of Congo, Mobutu Sese Seko, the old dictator who died quite quite recently in the last few years. He used to go there on the weekends, so to get out of the heat and dust of the city. So it's absolutely gorgeous. There's a huge forest. It's 75 acres, and the bonobos play in there all day, and then they come into night buildings, and, you know, in the morning before they get let out into the forest, we keep a couple of them behind to, like, play fun games with them.
But now, this is a home specifically for orphaned bonobos.
Yes, the Congolese, unfortunately, they eat bonobos. You know, there's 68 million people in that country, and the jungle is three times the size of France, and they have barely any agriculture. So, unfortunately, bonobos are quite a prized meat for hunters because they're easy to kill, and if you found one, you found 30 that you can kill at the same time. And so what happens is that usually the females, some of the females have an infant clinging to them, and these guys are too small to be bothered killing and eating, so the hunters sell them as pets, and these either end up in Kinshasa, the capital city, or trying to get smuggled out of the country to US, Europe, and the Middle East as pets.
And the Congo is quite a superstitious place as well. And
yes, so because bonobos look so much more like humans, I would say they actually look more like humans than chimpanzees because they're quite slender and they spend more of their time upright, and the females have more pronounced breasts. So the Congolese witch doctors occasionally use bits and pieces of bonobos to put in their juju or their magic. So, you know, some of these orphans arrive at the sanctuary in terrible condition. They've had, you know, we can just tell by the scars on their bodies that, you know, they've been locked in a cage and someone will come and snip off a finger, and then they'll come back 2 weeks later and they'll cut off another finger, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, the orphans who arrive are severely psychologically traumatized.
Some of the orphan stories that you talk about in the book are absolutely heartbreaking.
I know, they're gut-wrenching. It was actually a really gut-wrenching book to write, you know, just to have to go over some of those stories over and over again. It was tough.
So why have we been researching chimps for years? Why chimps specifically?
Well, like I said, they're like Anakin Skywalker. They have everything. They're a completely fascinating story. You know, they're almost like our mirror image. And when you're trying to figure out what it is that makes us human, the easiest thing to do is to look at our closest living relative to try and really find those differences. Because, you know, we could compare ourselves to, like, you know, a fish. But there's so many differences between humans and fish that it's kind of, you know, it's besides the point. And you need something that's much closer to humans before you can get real differences. And the closest living relatives to humans are chimpanzees, but also bonobos. So chimpanzees have really been the model for cognition studies for the last 40 years, and bonobos have just been completely ignored.
Well, how much genetic material do we actually share with them?
98.7.
And bonobos are exactly the same as chimps.
Yeah, bonobos are the same.
So in the book, you say that we study both chimps and bonobos to basically play spot the difference for what makes us human. Explain what that means.
Okay, so you remember that game you used to play in kindergarten where you were supposed to spot the difference between two cartoons, and maybe, you know, there were a picture of two cats, but in one the cat has a pink tail and then in the other one it has a blue one. So we do that with chimpanzees and bonobos to really try and figure out what it is that makes us human. So if we have something and chimpanzees don't have it, then originally we were like, oh my gosh, you know, this is what makes us human. But, you know, you really need bonobos because they're the other picture. And if you don't have them, then you're never going to really have a complete comparison. And we found things in bonobos that, you know, people were sure were unique to humans.
Like what?
Things like altruism. Did you hear about that parachuter? He was like in Texas and he jumped out of this plane and with a woman. He was a parachuting instructor. And so the parachute failed and she was, you know, beneath him. And what he did was he flipped himself around so that when they crashed to the ground, falling thousands of feet, he was cushioning her fall. And so, you know, heroic acts like these are something that people have said for years have been unique to humans, because she wasn't related to him. He didn't know her. She was basically a complete stranger. And yet he was prepared to sacrifice his life for hers. And so, you know, as humans, the definition of that is altruism. You do something for someone, a unrelated individual, at a great cost to yourself. And so, you know, we do this kind of thing all the time as humans. We'll, like, help little old ladies across the street. We'll donate blood. We'll, you know, give money to charities. And in chimps, they didn't really find much evidence of this, especially if you translate, you know, it into food. So a chimpanzee will not give food to a stranger. In fact, if they meet another strange chimpanzee, it's likely not to turn out very well. But we just found on the last research trip that, you know, bonobos will actually go to a locked door, unlock the door, and let in a stranger to, like, share food with them. So that was something really amazing, I think. And it's just a classic example of, if you don't look at bonobos, then you're, as well as chimpanzees, then you're never really going to have the full picture.
Well, actually, I would like to hear more about that test, the cooperation test. Can you explain it?
Okay, so the cooperation test is, you have a long plank, and on either end you have food. And through this plank is threaded a rope, sort of like a shoelace. And so the original test was with chimpanzees. And so cooperation in humans is something we're really interested in. It's actually also really quite complicated, because in order to cooperate successfully, you have to, number one, know that you need someone else, like when you need someone and when you don't. Number two is that you have to be able to pick a good cooperator. Like, you know, you don't want to pick the loser cooperator. And number three is that you have to be prepared to retaliate if that person doesn't end up cooperating with you. Otherwise, you know, you're just going to get walked all over. So chimpanzees, when we did this task, so each chimpanzee had to pull the rope at the same time to pull the plank towards them and get the food. And chimpanzees were incredible at this, and they showed all the relevant cognition, you know, pertaining to cooperation. So they, you know, they knew when they did and didn't need to cooperate. They chose good partners. They preferred, you know, partners who were good. And then they punished the chimps who weren't good cooperators by, you know, not choosing them the next time if they had a choice. So chimpanzees were absolutely fantastic. But where chimpanzee cooperation just completely fell apart was not on a cognitive level, it was sort of their emotions. So if they were put with someone they didn't like, or if they were put with someone, you know, who was a little bit older and a little bit more threatening, you know, and there was a chance that they would steal all the food, they completely refused to cooperate. And it's just really funny watching the videos, because you can see that they, oh my God, it was like, you know that South Carolina senator, when Obama was giving his State of the Nation and he was bringing up immigration, and then that senator, you know, classic cooperation scenario, he's trying to get everybody with the program, and that South Carolina, I think his name was Joe Wilson, just screamed out, right, "You lie." Do you remember that?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, classic chimpanzee. Oh my God, that was so chimpanzee. You know, those are cooperative situations, but someone's emotions just got the better of them and they just couldn't do it anymore. And, you know, Joe Wilson said later, he said, you know, "I didn't plan that. It was like an outburst." And it was. You could, like, see it in his face. He was totally red, and he just couldn't stand it anymore. And that is what happens to chimpanzees. Whereas bonobos, their emotions seem completely different. So they will cooperate with anyone. Like, they will cooperate across age, across gender. Like, it didn't matter who was in the test, but they would do it, and they would do it beautifully. And in some ways that's, you know, much more like humans, because we are generally as a species incredibly cooperative. But in some ways they were better than humans, because there is this point where, you know, we tend to cooperate better with those we see as being like us. So those of the same race or the same religion or the same political convictions, same sports teams, whatever it is, that, you know, we like to cooperate with those who we feel are in our group, and we are not such good cooperators with those who we think are not of our group.
Audience, if you have questions for Vanessa Woods, author of Bonobo Handshake, you can email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So you say in the book that cooperation is based on tolerance.
Yes, and this is something extremely important, because we tend to think of human cooperation is very cognitive, like it's something that's defined by intelligence. You know we have to cooperate, and so therefore we do. But we tend to ignore the emotional factor and just how much our emotions can get in the way. And this is extremely important and poignant for countries like Congo, where, you know, cooperation, the traditional cooperation systems like the justice system, like the police enforcement system, like, you know, the banks, everything has just completely collapsed. And it's really important for us to understand how human cooperation works so we can try and, you know, make sure that when these this kind of intolerance or these emotions start to get in the way, that we can, you know, somehow get around those.
Well, you did other testing on the differences between how chimps tolerate and how bonobos do, specifically using pictures. That's the research I'm talking about.
Yeah, so that was really, really interesting. So when I'm talking about you know, seeing people as being in our group or not, either being us or them. So chimpanzees had this really interesting... So we showed basically the chimpanzees and bonobos pictures of apes that they knew and pictures of apes that they didn't know. So with the chimpanzees, the strongest result that we saw was the chimpanzee females did not like to look at the strange males. And, you know, this completely makes sense because in chimpanzee society, you know, a strange male, if you're a female, is likely to come and beat you up and kill your baby. So in bonobos, we didn't see any of that. Like the bonobos, they like to look at the strangers and the not strangers the same. So chimps really have a very strong sense of us and them. And, you know, basically, if you take a group of chimpanzees at the zoo and you separate them, 6 months later, you can't put them back in together because there will be serious, serious violence. And it sort of reminds me of the Stanford prison experiment that Zimbardo did in the 70s, right, where he took this standard group of white, middle-class American male students, and he just designated. He's like, okay, half of you are the prisoners and half are the guards. And then within, like, hours, there were signs of abuse for the prisoners against from the guards against the prisoners. They would make them simulate homosexual sex. They would, you know, withdraw their bathroom privileges. They would lock them up in isolation. So, you know, as humans, we really share this kind of dark side with chimpanzees, that if we feel like someone is not of our group, then this is the time where this violence and aggression can occur. And yes, it is usually in men. It's very strong in men.
There was even a physiological response to those tests.
Yes, so, yeah, and if the chimpanzees even heard the voice of a stranger, their right ear temperature went up, which is, you know, correlated with anxiety and stress. And, it's not something that they thought about. This is something that's very emotional for them and something that they can't necessarily control.
We have an email question.
Do you think that bonobos' seeming altruism is just practical long-term thinking? Could they possibly understand that it's more sustainable to share now in hopes of some kind of benefit later?
That's an excellent question. So that is reciprocal altruism. And so we see that in, like, vampire bats. So a bat will come along and share blood with a hungry cavemate just in the hope that in the future that cavemate will pay them back. What's different about human altruism and bonobo altruism is that they would do it with a stranger. So, of course, you know, with the heroic skydiver, yeah, there's always a chance that maybe someone along the line will pay him back for the kindness he did. But, I mean, really, that the fact that they would do that for someone that they've never met before and potentially may never see it again, I mean, that is altruism. And, you know, who knows? Of course, you could always meet someone further along the line, but just that was the special thing about human altruism, is that, you know, this is a stranger that they've never seen before, potentially they never see them again, and still they, you know, either, you know, they sacrifice something for them. And this is what happened with the bonobos. Bonobo they've never seen before, don't know if they're going to see them again. They did essentially the same thing.
So there are some other fairly specific differences between chimps and bonobos, and you mentioned it's a matriarchy in the bonobo society.
Yeah, so bonobos are definitely ruled by the females. If a male bonobo starts to get any big chimpanzee ideas, he will be what the Mars at the sanctuary call corrected by the females. And I get this sometimes... you know, people get a bit upset because they're like, well, you can't just say that bonobos never have violence, because they do have violence, but it's a very different violence from chimpanzees. So in bonobo society, it's usually the females that use violence to maintain peace in the group. In chimpanzees, it's usually the males who are using violence to assert dominance and maintain control.
Now, you mentioned in the book, and I find this fascinating, that bonobos don't have to compete for food. So the females are free to form alliances. Why the difference between chimps and bonobos?
Well, the theory is, and this is Richard Wrangham's theory, who wrote Demonic Males, is that chimpanzees, they ecologically, they developed where resources were quite tight. So, you know, they have to go quite a long way to find fruiting trees, protein, like, so hunting monkeys was, you know, hitting the jackpot. It's sort of like mammoth hunting. So, you know, there's a lot of investment that goes into foraging, and then there's occasionally like really big payoffs, like, you know, catching meat. So this introduces like this element of competition, and the male and females can't afford to hang out together because they've all got their babies, and it's kind of like everyone for themselves. And then this gives the opportunity for the males to guard the resources and collect the resources and to fight one another off against the resources, then to get access to the females. But so bonobos kind of live in a salad bowl. They eat this very herbaceous root, and it's really nutritious, so there's not really much competition for that. And so the females can like hang out together. And so the rule in bonobo society is that, you know, one male might be stronger than any female, but no male is stronger than five females. So this is how, you know, this is how they keep male aggression under control, is that the females just really stick together.
And that's interesting, because there definitely is the sense that the females keep everything under control.
Yes, and that is a really good lesson, I think, for humans. Actually, on NPR, the reporter asked me if it was a good lesson for the Congolese women, because, you know, Congolese, the women in Congo have just suffered from the most atrocious violence, and something like 400,000 women have been raped, and this is probably, you know, the numbers are probably much higher, and it's raped viciously in unimaginable ways. And so, you know, I thought, yes, it is a good lesson for the Congolese women, but I think it's also a good lesson for women everywhere, because even in America, where violence against women is illegal, something like one in six women suffer from violence or domestic abuse every year. And, you know, so that's quite high. And also, women in Congo, they tend to have a greater sense of community, whereas women in America suffering from domestic violence tend to isolate themselves. And so, you know, bonobos just have a really good message, is that, you know, women who stick together are more protected.
I don't know if you've checked Wikipedia in the last while, but it says on the Wikipedia page for bonobos that bonobos are led by an alpha male, and that matriarchies only occur in captivity. So is there disagreement on this?
Wikipedia? Oh, you mean Wikipedia reported something incorrectly? Because,
I see what you're saying.
Go onto Wikipedia and like do whatever they want. I mean, you know, I could go update your page on Wikipedia and say that you are like a rock star, which of course you are. And I could say your dad was like Michael Jackson, and no one would like pull that down for like, you know, at least a day. So what did it say, that bonobos are not?
They're led by an alpha male, and that matriarchies only occur in captivity.
No.
Okay. So what we're doing right now is we're requesting volunteers.
Hello, Wikipedia. No, the most dominant individual in a bonobo group is always a female. Now, there is an alpha male, but, you know, and actually, do you know what? I'm just going to, like, shake all this up and say that the most dominant individual in a bonobo group is the babies. Because, you know, they did this study where they, and the way we test for dominance in our experiments is that we put food in between two individuals, and whoever gets that food is the dominant individual. So you can put like a peanut in between like a baby bonobo and the alpha male, and he's going to get it. Because, you know, the baby's backed up by their mother and then those five other females. So, I hate to burst anyone's bubble, but Wiki's wrong on that one.
So we're looking for volunteers now. Anybody that has access to changing Wikipedia pages?
Yeah, please update the Wiki page.
Please
Maybe
do.
I'll go do it after this. The audience might also like to know that there is this there was this big thing which was so 1988 when Franz Roll reported on bonobo's sexuality that, you know, this was something that was somehow caused by captivity. And, I mean, you know, this was way back when, like, Madonna was dating Sean Penn. And, like, we didn't even barely have the internet. So
your cultural references are awesome. That's all I have to say. Do continue.
Thanks, Desiree. I thought your people would appreciate it. And you know, it just drives me absolutely crazy because, you know, there was also that article in the New Yorker that came out in 2007 saying, oh, you know, bonobos don't even have that much sex. And, you know, part of it is that the data was just not there because all they had, you know, there wasn't the amount of data on wild studies that there was for chimpanzees. And so people were kind of going, oh, well, maybe bonobos do hunt and kill each other and maybe they don't even have that much sex and maybe it's just because somehow they got put in a zoo that they started behaving abnormally. And I can tell everyone definitively that that's just is completely not true. And we have found differences in the physiology of chimpanzees and bonobos that show they are completely different. So I just did this study with the, so the sex is always the big thing because sex sells bonobos, and so that was what people were trying to take down, that there was any difference between the sexuality of bonobos and chimpanzees. But I did this study and baby bonobos are hypersexual from infancy. And this is, you know, we showed this in the orphans, which means that they didn't, you know, and they arrived at like between 1 and 2 years of age, which means they didn't have any social or cultural references. They were in an orphan group. There were no adults around having sex. So, and they had sex like crazy. And in the same scenario, chimpanzee orphans did not. And when we measured the testosterone, one of our students, Tori Wober from our research group, she found that bonobo babies had crazy high testosterone. Like, it was ridiculous. Like, in 2007, the bonobo with the most testosterone was, like, a four-year-old female called Masisi. Like, they just... So bonobos, number one, they have a lot of sex. Number two, they are the most dominant individual in a group is a female. And number three, they are very, very different to chimpanzees. So Wiki can just suck on that.
And we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back to talk about bonobo sex after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we talk to John Cook, author of Skeptical Science, a website that examines the science behind climate change denial. What are the most common arguments used to create doubt about global warming, and are they supported by anything resembling real evidence? And on Speaking Up, we talked to Meg Askey, director of the Flagstaff Film Festival, about their science and skepticism program. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm on the line with Vanessa Woods, author of Bonobo Handshake. Now, you brought up sex, so now we're going to talk about this. First of all, the title of the book is Bonobo Handshake, so what does that refer to?
Well, it's really funny because my publishers decide to put a picture of me and a bonobo shaking hands on the cover of my book, but that is actually not what a bonobo handshake is.
No, I found that rather amusing, really.
No, I know. I'm like, did you even read the book, you publishing people? So it turns out that a bonobo handshake is when two females rub their clitorises together and we think they orgasm. They look like they're orgasming. So, you know, in the kind of the primatology world, this is what a bonobo handshake is.
They're a friendly bunch.
Do you want
bunch.
To ask me about their clitoris? Because I saw stuff on Twitter going earlier today. I think you want to ask me about their clitorises, so go ahead.
But you already brought them up. You know what? The way you describe them in the book, actually, there were a number of points in the book that I actually blushed. I felt like I was reading softcore porn. They're very human, my friend.
I didn't even put the worst stuff in there. The worst stuff I saw, like, you know, like less than a year ago, and that didn't get to go in the book. Okay, but yes, the bonobo clitorises, they are extraordinary. They are long, they're pink, and I mean, they can curl around an iron bar. I mean, this is how...
This is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, and even the baby females, and you know, they're kind of like this little, like they rub them up against you because as humans, we are the ones with the hang-ups. I mean, and the other reason why I called it the book Bonobo Handshake was because for bonobos, sex just isn't a big deal. It's kind of like a handshake. It's like a, hi, how are you? I'm okay, you're okay. Let's rub our clitorises together and that will make us feel nice and socially facilitate whatever event this is.
That's what I found so interesting is the fact that you talk about the matriarchy and you talk about the females correcting the males, but it's also they control the situation through sex.
Yes, and that is the big thing about bonobos, but I would just like to say that I think the reason why bonobos have been, or well, one of the reasons why they've been ignored for so long is just that their sex is so outrageous and people can't seem to move past that. But the most important thing about bonobos and the thing that they really can teach us is that they live in a society without violence. So just like bonobo cooperation, we can learn from bonobo cooperation. You know, I live in a pretty small town, like, you know, close to somewhere called Durham. And last week up the road, someone got shot, you know, where I go to get my clinical visits. And then something like 20 people a year are murdered here. And I'm sure, you know, in the U.S., there's over 1,000 murders a year. And, you know, going beyond the U.S., in Congo, like I said, the death toll is up to 5.4 million, like 1,500 people die a day over there. And, you know, and the rest of the world, the Upsala conflict database says that there's 7 wars going on right now that kill over 1,000 people a year. And so, you know, conflict and violence and murder is a really huge part of who we are. And when I wake up in the morning, I know that there's a chance that someone might kill me. Like, without question, someone might kill me. And when a chimpanzee wakes up in the morning, they have exactly the same thought, you know? And as a matter of fact, if you're a male chimpanzee, you are more likely to be killed by another male, a male chimpanzee, than by anything else. And so I would give up all this stuff that we have just to wake up as a bonobo, because they don't have that. And that's the most intelligent thing about them. And that is why I always say that they're the most intelligent ape.
So why is there no war in bonobo culture? Is it because they're having so much sex?
You know, we don't really know. It's the sex and it's the play. So, you know, sex is just their mechanism, but they also play a lot. And actually during our experiments, like for the cooperation, there was actually more play than sex. So they seem to have retained this kind of juvenile, this kind of Peter Pan thing. They never really grew up. So, you know, younger animals tend to have more sex and play more, and this is what bonobos do. And it's not exactly sex, it's like sociosexual behavior. So it's like rubbing up against one another and playing with each other's genitals and that kind of thing.
So what can we learn from this?
I think we can learn that sex is probably not going to be our mechanism, because I don't know about you, but I look around me on any given day and I do not feel like rubbing my clitoris on any of the people that I see on a day-to-day basis. So for humans, I do not think it's going to be sex, but, you know, we owe it to ourselves to find out what the mechanism is. And, you know, bonobos are just incredibly important because, you know, their physiology, their psychology, we need to be looking at them, because that's going to be the key to a world without violence. You know, and we're not going to become bonobos, and I don't suggest that we do become bonobos, but they have something to teach us. And their numbers are going down so rapidly that, you know, if we don't save them, then we're going to lose it. And then, you know, we're never really going to have a chance to solve this problem, or really even to understand ourselves.
Now, Vanessa, I realize you want to talk about war. I think my audience wants to talk about sex.
More about the clitorises. Yes. Do you want to know the biggest one I've ever seen? It was about the size of, like, my thumb. Incredible. And can I also say, for the first time on Skeptically Speaking, the thing that actually shocked me after 5 years, you know, basically looking at bonobo sex, can I tell you the most shocking thing I ever saw?
I am
ever?
So excited. Do it.
So there was this mother, she was nursing her son, the nurse, and her son had gotten to the stage where, like, he wanted to nurse and her boobs were sore and she'd had enough of it, right? She was trying to wean him, basically. He was getting to about 2 years old. And he started to absolutely just throw a fit. Like, he was just shrieking and screaming and crying. And she masturbated him to keep him quiet. And I was just like, okay, there's something really wrong about that. I know that, you know, I've seen bonobos a lot, but I'm like, a mother just debated her little boy so he would stop crying for her milk. And, you know, it worked. So there you go. Good housekeeping, southern living. take that and think, nursing mothers everywhere, think about it.
Think hard. So there's no incest with bonobos, though. Like, for all their promiscuity.
No. There is, like, sexual contact between family relations, for sure. But what happens is that when female bonobos reach adolescence, they migrate to a different group. So,
well, good.
Good. Well, it's all good. Yeah. Oh, maybe bonobos are endangered because they're just so inbred. Maybe if they stop having sex with their relatives, you know, that they actually have a good gene pool. No, that's not it. It's not it. And they definitely know. And a lot of the sex isn't to completion. It's more like a handshake thing.
I have so many questions sitting here. Sorry, guys, we're not even remotely going to get to them. I'm going to try and get to a few. Here's a question from the website.
Do bonobos exhibit jealousy?
Yes, they are extremely jealous. And as a matter of fact, the interesting thing that just firsthand that I experienced it is this bonobo called Malu. She completely fell in love with my husband. And, you know, once she'd figured out that I was his woman, she started attacking me. And she'd never had a problem with me before, but she would, like, bungee jump off my hair. She would, like, kick me. She would, she was, like, basically just torturing me. And I expected him to defend me being a good southern male. But he was just like, oh, Malu, she's so cute. She's so beautiful. And nothing was done. And I was actually had to leave the nursery whenever Brian came. Or I'd be covered in bruises.
I'm going to sneak in one more question from the website.
We've all heard about the promiscuity of bonobos, but I was wondering if they have threesomes too.
Ha! Threesomes! I've seen like sixsomes. I have seen like 20-somes, whatever that is. Like, yeah, this is serious business here. All you have to do is like throw in a box of apples because apples, for some reason, are their favorite fruit. I don't get it, but they are. And yeah, the whole group, they'll be, and you know, it's a marathon session. We're talking 30 minutes. This is not, they have serious stamina.
Okay, I'm gonna dispense with the sex, everybody. I apologize. I know we have like 20 questions sitting here because I do want to get back to the war part because although the sex is very interesting, I do find it more interesting the fact that bonobos don't have war. So if we're talking about trying to figure out what separates us from bonobos, it's war. So what can we learn here?
Well, it's really just this situation in which humans feel that somebody is part of them and not a part of us. So we need to recognize that's true. And I get a lot of I was on the Intersection, that blog, and I was just talking about this biological basis for aggression. And people get really upset. They get really upset when you suggest that war is somehow a natural behavior. And I just say it's just a naturalistic fallacy. Just because it is some way doesn't mean that it ought to be that way. And with something like war and violence, it is crucial that we understand everything about it, including the situations in which it's most likely to occur, because we do have this gigantic intellects, and it is possible for us to overcome our emotions. So unlike chimpanzees who cannot cooperate because they're so intolerant, humans can do it. We can definitely do it. We recognize that we need to do it, but we need to understand more about the situations in which these occur so we can really manage.
So how many bonobos are left in the world, approximately?
Ooh, that's a tough question, and nobody really knows, but it could be as few as 10,000.
So tell us about Friends of the Bonobos.
Oh, Friends of Bonobos. If you go to their website, it's friendsofbonobos.org. I work for this American-based charity that supports Lolaya Bonobo and Friends of Bonobos in Congo, who are doing all this amazing work. They look after all these orphans. They have this massive education program that looks after that has like 30,000 people a year coming through the sanctuary, most of whom are children. So, if you want to protect bonobos for the future, then it's really the future generation that you have to target. And actually last year, for the first time, they released a group of orphan bonobos back into the wild. So it was a really nice story. And those orphans are doing great. And they do amazing, amazing work.
And that's all the time we have. Thanks very much for being here, Vanessa.
Oh, that was fun. Okay, so anyone who wants to, ask me all those sex questions, feel free. Bonobohandshake.com. You'll find all my contact details there. So go nuts.
And you can find that link as well as the link to Lolo Ye Bonobo Sanctuary and Friends of Bonobos at our website, skepticallyspeaking.com. There are also links to our Facebook page, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online, reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, woo. I don't think you understand, it's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.